Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. I am your host, Logan Bartlett, and what you're going to hear on this episode is a conversation I had with Jan Tallon. Jan is the billionaire co-founder of Skype, as well as an angel investor in a number of the most notable AI companies out there, including Anthropic, which is a spin-out of OpenAI, as well as DeepMind, which was acquired by Google in 2014 and forms the backbone of their artificial intelligence initiatives. Jan takes a different approach to investing, where he actually tries to influence the outcomes of the company so that they don't accelerate us on a path to AI doom. We have a really interesting conversation about AI and all the risks that are coming up, as well as the early days of Skype and what it was like for Jan to lend $100 million to Sam Bankman-Fried and what he saw in Alameda and FTX. A really interesting conversation with an excellent entrepreneur and someone that's actually trying to do good in the world with their dollars. Trust you'll enjoy that conversation here now. All right, Jan, thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Can you take me through your discovery of crypto and what your journey has been with that over the course of the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, I think I stumbled upon Bitcoin in 2010 I just found the idea very fascinating. I think in general, I find like interesting ideas that people in my peer group, at least, don't pay attention to, and then AI risk being a thing and crypto being a thing, definitely like prime examples. And then I even like remember like preparing a presentation from my family office that I share with other Estonian Skype founders. And then like saying, look, Bitcoin is really, really, really interesting idea. And we should invest. And people were like, yeah, that is very interesting. And then just like forgot about it. I was like, okay, I'll just invest myself then.
It must have been pretty lucrative for you. But what do you still hold the same optimism that you did for crypto in the early days today, or as you've seen it evolve, has your perspective changed?
I think the main thing is that like currently AI is just this, specifically these like large AI summoning experiments are this like the big steamroller. Like everything else, including crypto, including global warming, including world economy, everything else is just like a penny in front of it. So like, can we stop this steamroller? And like, once we can stop this steamroller, then we have time to think about, okay, what else interesting is out there? And definitely one of the things that I still pay attention to and like would pay more attention to is crypto, especially like Ethereum and like these kind of global consensus building tools that might be useful even in AI.
I'd be remiss not to ask about your relationship or investment in SBF at one point. I saw there was a Wall Street Journal or maybe on your Wikipedia page, it said that you had loaned Sam money. So can you just tell me the story of what that relationship was? How'd you actually meet him and how you ended up loaning something? I saw $100 million, but can you tell that story for people?
Yeah, I mean, it must go fairly mundane story, and even though like the amount was significant, I was just visiting California in I think early 2018, and I had already heard about Sam SBF from some of his colleagues at Chain Street Capital, where he was kind of apparently considered like a really, really good trader. And I was aware of the Wild West of crypto markets, having developed my own bots to kind of train like at least exchange things there. And I was aware that these are inefficient things. So like I was like, okay, there's like a confluence of these inefficient markets, this amazing, apparently amazing trader, and then like a lot of investors who I respected and still respect, them like investing big, at least according to their, relative to their net worth in this operation called Alameda. And then I was like, oh, that's interesting. Let me do some like investment here as well. And then I just visited them, saw this operation. I was like, I mean, there was electricity went out when I was visiting their office. So one of my big feedbacks for them is that like, please make your operation kind of like more resilient and more constrained. On the other hand, it was kind of understandable that they were like going after like a fleeting arbitrage opportunity. So like, of course, there's always trade-offs between between how kind of scrappy you are, like how sort of conscientious you are versus how much kind of opportunity you can get from the arbitrage.
Did you ultimately take the money back out of Alameda, or were you a participant in FTX and all the losses?
Okay, yeah, I got almost all my funds back just a few months later as the Japan arbitrage actually dried out. And then like there was like a smaller amount that I think was there for another year. So like I think somewhere in 2019, I was like completely out. And after that, I think I only met Sam once in Bahamas for like a brief visit. We had like FLI, Future Flight Institute's like offsite in Bahamas, and then just like paid FTX a small visit, and that was it.
Did you ever try to invest in FTX?
No, I don't think I was like given this opportunity. I mean, I'm not in the US, etc. So like sometimes I hear about such opportunities, sometimes I don't.
In hindsight, I'm sure you've replayed your interactions, or at least been asked by people like me to replay your interactions with Sam. Was there anything that you feel like you would have otherwise missed or that you did miss in those interactions? Or do you just chalk it up to the randomness of people and motivations and incentives that we ended up in the place that we did with FTX?
So there's like this theoretical thing that I like heard from podcasts, etc., not by directly talking to him. Is his kind of like very fanatical defense of this no marginal diminishing returns when betting. Like there's this concept called Kelly betting that you're very supposed to kind of like not bet like your entire pot at every opportunity versus what I now call Bankman betting that says that no, you should like bet everything. That really sounded strange, but like I can't say like how much kind of like this like hindsight bias is now speaking. It's possible. It's like very possible that I would have invested in FTX if presented in the right way.
In retrospect, there were no characteristics or things that stood out from the meetings that you had with him that said, oh, yes, this person was capable of that, or any way that you informed future investments because
the main,
of that interaction.
The main thing that I now remember was that like this investor that I absolutely respected back then, I continue to respect. He basically said that, look, Sam is a loose cannon. He cannot be trusted. And okay. So that definitely was
is that someone that worked with him?
Yeah, that was like investor in Alameda. So, like one investor in Alameda basically withdrew and said that, like, no, you should not trust Sam. But that was like one word against like a bunch of people who I had met and some of them I'm still friends with.
Once upon a time, I think you held the record for most software downloads ever between Kazaa and Skype. Can we talk through like your entrepreneurial journey and how Kazaa ultimately led to Skype for you?
I guess the roots of that go back to my primary and high school. Like one little known fact is that the co-founders of Skype, we had like seven people who got founding shares, and four of them were Estonians, and they all were, you know, my classmates either in primary or in high school.
Was that totally coincidental, by the way? Like, did you go to some special school for gifted engineering students or something?
So, the high school was kind of elite math and physics class, but my primary school was not. One person I met in my primary school and the others in my high school.
You got to be friends with these people in school, and then how did that end up with both Kazaa and Skype?
My high school ended at the time when Estonia regained its independence, and literally entrepreneurship became legal. One of the first things I did was like establish a company, and together with my high school friends, and we started doing computer games. In fact, I spent 10 years of my life running a games company in Estonia. We called ourselves Estonian Games Industry because that we were the only one back then. Now there are others and more famous ones. We were called Blue Moon Interactive. The site is still up there, bluemoon.ee. It looks very much from the 90s because it is from the 90s.
you're behind the Iron Curtain for all of your childhood through high school. How did you go about like even thinking, hey, we should start a company and this is what it should look like? I assume there wasn't a YC for Estonia in the early 90s. So like, how did you go about thinking that this should, what the path could be to actually starting a business?
I don't remember like the exact details. I mean, one important fact to kind of mention here is that, I mean, Estonia was independent before the Soviet occupation. And I grew up with my grandparents, so who like barely skipped a day without kind of reminiscing what the Estonian independence looked like and how great it was. More generally, in the cultural memory of Estonians, the independence period was like prominent. And many people considered the occupation temporary. So therefore, it wasn't like a complete shock when the occupation ended and capitalism came back.
I was probably in high school while this was going on, and I remember using Skype in the early days, but I don't remember the inevitability of something like Skype and whether or not it was self-evident that we were going to end up with something like this. Once you had looked at all the other players in the space, did it become pretty obvious from a technology standpoint that ultimately someone was going to solve this in a really good way, and it was more a feat of engineering that other people hadn't thus far? Or what was the market like at that point?
Yeah, I remember like this hilarious Slashdot post, Slashdot like a portal for hackers, and to have discussions about Skype, and there were like many complaints. People said that like, well, we've always had like peer-to-peer, or we always had like voice over IP software. And then like one comment there was that, oh yeah, we've had those things. Like it's easier. You basically like take this particular solution. You have to compile it on your computer. Then you have to like fix this box because it doesn't compile immediately. Then you have to open your ports. Then you have to like put register a gateway and make sure you're connected. Then you have to solve these problems. And then like after a few points like that, well, and now you're ready to talk to people just like you. So it's like the big problem was that like all the existing voice over IP programs, they were kind of very demanding on the user and their kind of like technological know-how. You need to know what the ports are, how to open them, how to do like port forwarding, things like that. So you could kind of establish connections between computers that weren't really meant to be directly connected.
In that regard, like was the accomplishment a feat of product and packaging, or was it a function of engineering and being able to technically do this? I'm just wondering why you guys were able to succeed versus everyone else.
Yeah, it was both, really. The thing that was rising back then, standard, I mean, the standard is still around, was SIP, Session Initiation Protocol, which roughly models voice over IP communications after email. And as we all know, like it's like, especially now, it's really difficult to have like your own email service. Like you need to have like some corporation that kind of like placed a corporation either from your ISP or from Google or whatever, kind of centralized thing. And then you have a chicken or egg problem because like in order to have this like standard compliant voice over IP communication, you need like a middleman, but the middleman doesn't materialize automatically. There needs to be like a demand for this middleman. So like you have chicken and egg problem. And then we had thought that because given our peer-to-peer knowledge and existing technology in the form of like this technology general index to develop for Gazaar 2, we basically had this idea, okay, wait a minute, we have the technology to both find and connect users regardless of their whatever networking setup that they have. So that was like the technological approach or innovation. And then on the product side, people that thought that, okay, like once we have the ability to kind of connect users in a way where they don't have to worry about underlying networking conditions, like how to make it as intuitive as possible. Like, first version of Skype was just like one green button and one red button to call and hang up, and then just like update the search and add users, and that's pretty much it.
I heard you say at one point that Skype made all the mistakes in the world, but it didn't matter. Once you had that green button and red button and the functionality worked, did people find it and it just started taking off, or did it take a little while to get going?
Oh, it went just like immediately. It was pretty insane. Again, we had this online counter, how many users are connected. And initially, after we launched, we just like called our friends and it's like, come online, just to make the counter go up, make the number go up. And totally we saw like, okay, it doesn't matter. Like if you're going to call more friends, it just like keeps going up now. And then at one point I plotted the number on a log scale, and it was like a basically perfect exponential growth that I calculated that like it was August, September 2003, and calculate, okay, before the end of the year, we're going to run out of people on the planet. We need like Martians to join. But then of course it like leveled off. So it took off really quickly. Multiple reasons. One was like, yeah, the product market fit was like just really good. Especially in Europe where the long distance calls, there was like a lot of demand for long distance calls that were free. And the other thing was that Skype, because it was so international project from the start, there are like still 5 countries in the world who think that Skype is their invention, Sweden and Denmark, because Janos and Niklas were from Denmark and Sweden respectively. London, because the main business office was in London. Estonia, because it was made in Estonia. And Luxembourg, because Skype was a Luxembourg company. So like we got like kind of patriotic press from 5 different countries. Is that like the makers of Kazaa, Sweden finally shows people what it's capable of by the makers of Kazaa, this next generation thing. And then like, yeah, it's just like we got a lot of positive press and because in combination with the product market fit, it just exploded immediately.
Yeah, success has many fathers, right? I imagine no one would have claimed it the other way. If you hadn't had the level of success, everyone would have denied that you were from there. But so what were some of the mistakes you made along the way that your growth and things were just able to paper over?
I think the most interesting mistake we made was like being like overly, smug and confident about the advantages of peer-to-peer. We kind of used to. In fact, I gave a talk like 10 years ago. It was called like "So You Want to Be a Technology Developer." So if you search my name and this on YouTube, you see basically talk about AI, but like I used the illustration from what happened with Skype when we kind of got overly confident about our technology and our understanding of the technology. So in particular, we kind of like were very smug and kind of joked about like Yahoo and MSN because they were like, their servers were down every once in a while, and we were like, we're peer-to-peer, we're never gonna go down. And then I think August 2007 happened, where Skype was down for like almost 48 hours. And that was very interesting. We just like woke up and like Skype didn't connect. Like what the hell is going on? And then Ahti Heinla, who was the chief technical architect, one of the co-founders, he compiled a special version of Skype to kind of peek to the connect to the network and see like what's happening in the network to understand why isn't Skype connecting? Skype knows connecting to each other. And as a result, like it wasn't his computer that crashed. It wasn't the software that crashed. It was like his ISP, his internet provider, that crashed. So basically there was like this like massive hailstorm of spam that Skype knows were like sending out because there was this positive feedback loop in some of our peer-to-peer traffic patterns. We basically took 2 days to try to get this thing under control again.
So Skype sold to eBay, and was it 2005?
Yeah, September 2005. So like in 2 years, after 2 years.
After 2 years, and you all made hundreds of millions of dollars from this sale.
I mean, not all of us, but yeah, some more, yes, some less.
Yes. So this happens, and you stayed on with eBay through when?
Yeah, I kind of started gradually easing out in like 2008, 2009. One thing that happened in 2009 was that there was this lawsuit. eBay had like a change of management and decided to sell Skype. And then there were a couple of consortiums that were very kind of bidding, private equity consortiums bidding for the for Skype. At the moment where Skype was sold, Niklas and Janos had started another company called Juiced that was trying to use that software stack for basically content like TV, peer-to-peer TV. So that was like this lawsuit that kind of prevented me from actively participating at Skype for like half a year. And when I came back at the end of 2009, that place had changed enough that I didn't really feel at home anymore. So I think at the end of 2010, Microsoft ended up buying Skype from this private equity consortium that eBay. So Skype has been sold like 3 or 4 times, depending how you count.
You've made more money than you think you're probably ever going to need. You've been a part of something that presumably would be your life's work in terms of just like impact and implications and all that. And so what are you doing? What's your feeling through this period of time?
Yeah. It was like the first time when I needed to sit back and think about, okay, what I am going to do with my life now. And a friend of mine asked me that, so how does it feel to have your life's work done at such an early age?
How old were you at the time?
I was early 30s.
Did you feel sort of aimless with it, or was it very gratifying?
So one thing that I already started stumbling upon, every once in a while, I started stumbling upon these essays written by this strange guy called Eliezer Yudkowsky. And I found them very fascinating. And started reading more and more, and then discovered that he had written 1,000 essays. and at that one point, I think it was early 2009, in March 2009, I was in Bay Area on Skype Business, and I just cold emailed him and said hi, I'm co-founder of Skype, do you want to meet? And that's how we met. And after our 4-hour discussion in Millbrae, near San Francisco Airport, I made $5,000 donation to what now known as Miri, and thought that okay, now this is really important, a really underappreciated topic that I need to educate myself much more and see how can I help.
And what crystallized from his writings, as well as that conversation for you around artificial intelligence and where things were headed?
One essay that really shook me was Staring into Singularity by Eliezer, essay that he now has disavowed, or for a long time has disavowed, as way too optimistic. But it was just very, very impressive piece of writing. That again, it didn't highlight the actual problem, but it highlighted the magnitude of the thing that we are facing. So that certainly caught my attention. And then started reading his essays on overcoming bias, now less wrong, so-called sequences. I even wrote a script for myself to scrape all these things and reformat it in a way to make it easier to read for myself. And this guy saw that, okay, he's just making so many good points. And he's I appreciate the strength of the arguments as well as how much I'm learning from his writings. But then I had a bunch of objections that I wrote up. And when we met in 2009, I just went with a laundry list of counterpoints. There were things why do we give AI access to internet? Why don't why don't they just keep it in a box and have like, why don't we run it in a kind of virtual machine, things like that. And then like basically shut them down like one by one in a way that was like, okay, yep, there are no bugs in his argument.
Unlike many in the industry today, you've had both this concern, which I think is probably shared by people more today than it was back then, but you also had means to do something about it, right? Through the Skype acquisition, you had hundreds of millions of dollars and you had the time to go about doing things to try to make a change in the path that we were seemingly on or you thought we were on. And so how did you think about what choices you were going to make and the ultimate founding of the Center for Existential Risk and the Future of Life Institute?
I mean, now I have like much more kind of explicit model of my kind of strategic resources. Back then I was working more on a like implicit model of them. And I call them kind of game of civilization model of resources, which kind of, there are like four kinds of resources that kind of correspond to resources in a game of civilization. So they are gold, which is finances. Then there is, squinting a little, the attention that corresponds to production in civilization. Basically, yeah, what are you focusing on? Then brand that corresponds to culture in civilization, and turns left, which corresponds to, well, kind of like self-obvious. So one thing that I at least implicitly realized, and then like several people told me, is that I have this the brand resource. So unlike Eliezer, who back then wasn't that well known, like I could basically take the arguments and repackage them and come from like a different angle and get kind of audiences with different people. One of my friends once said is that like it's possible that the main contribution of Skype to humanity was that it gave me an excuse to be in the room. So I just like cooled email people and went to conferences, walked up to Demis. That's like one thing that I did at one point.
Demis, the founder and CEO of DeepMind.
Exactly. Yeah. And I never met him before, was at the conference, walked up to him, we started talking. And apparently had already seen some of my presentations and ended up investing in DeepMind and becoming a board member. And then they were sold to Google, but I still gonna stay in touch with the crew there.
Yeah, and DeepMind sold to Google for $600 million, which I'm sure proved to be a great investment for you. But it sounded like kind of through this period in time, you had a meeting with Peter Thiel where he tried to tell you that convincing people and changing minds actually wasn't worth it and it was a failed effort that you were pursuing. Can you talk through that meeting and why that didn't discourage you?
Yeah, because Peter Thiel was the main supporter, as far as I understand, of MIRI, machine. Like back then they were called Singularity Institute. And so the head of Singularity Institute back then, Michael Vassar, made me like a ton of introductions in 2010. So I did like a kind of road trip in California talking to many of them. And Peter Thiel was one of my meetings. I mean, I don't remember like a lot from that meeting, even though I have some notes, but I did go to Peter with like a laundry list of things that I could be doing as an intervention in a situation where like nobody believes that this is real, but like, I believe it's real. Like Peter, by his kind of actions, seems to have believed that we might have a serious situation. And like on top of that list, indeed, was basically using my brand to talk to billionaires, but like kind of like just try to raise funds basically for the cause, and I think Michael Vassar called it high value networking, which again I was like in a much better position to do than someone like Eliezer. And Peter, as far as I remember, he was like, "Oh, this is completely useless. Like you're not gonna get any sense from billionaires." And looking back, yep, he was right. I didn't get any sense from billionaires. I've got have this joke / truism that I find it easier to spend X amount of time on making Y amount of dollars than raising same amount of time raising Y amount of dollars. for any X and Y. So but I still ended up talking to like a dozen different billionaires at one point or another. Because I thought it's worthwhile to try.
Was anyone receptive to it in 2010, these perspectives around singularity and the risk of artificial intelligence, or were most people pretty dismissive?
Yeah, not ever like very polite and interesting conversations. Interesting conversations, definitely. But like nothing never came out of them. And like the usual mood was that like, yeah, this is possible. I remember like talking to Vinod Khosla, for example, when at the end of meeting, he was like, yeah, this sounds like what Bill Joy was like talking about in this, like the future doesn't need us. And like, yeah, but like these are like something surely like in the long-term, indefinite, fuzzy future, like we shouldn't be concerned about this now. So I was like, yeah.
Bill Joy was Vinod Khosla's founder or co-founder at Sun Microsystems along with Scott McNeely, right?
Exactly.
So you're going about, you're meeting all these people, and ultimately you decide that one of the best paths to influence is actually investing in companies, not with a financial motive, but instead a desire to have a seat at the table and influence these companies around their efforts for artificial intelligence. And so you made investments in DeepMind, which sold to Google for $600 billion, as we referenced earlier, and now is a big part of Google's AI strategy, as well as more recently an investment in Anthropic, which is a spin out of OpenAI or a team from OpenAI building a large language model. So how did you actually decide on this model and go about executing on it?
I think it was kind of like grew naturally. Out of my meeting with Demis, I found it like both engaging and useful. And so I just like started thinking about, okay, this is something where I kind of like do get kind of access to the kitchens where that these things are being designed. And so I kind of started thinking about, okay, can I do it like more systematically? Like one trouble that I have, and like one criticism that I get, like typical criticism I get about this strategy is that like, hold on, like if you're kind of like are scared of AI, why do you invest in AI? And like, so the answer is that like, well, I need to think about not just about my impact, I need to think about my counterfactual impact. So like, what would happen if I didn't invest? What kind of money am I displacing? So that's like the story I at least tell to myself. Like when I invested in Anthropic, I think they even had like kind of term sheets from VCs back then. So the counterfactual was like very very clear. In DeepMind, I was like a minority shareholder that didn't really contribute much to their ability to run a company. But that said, yep, I think it's a fair criticism, and I kind of like need to think about these things. Even more in places where there are where I'm gonna participate with like larger tickets and perhaps like more upstream technologies such as like hardware, things that are kind of like enablers or like addressing some kind of bottlenecks in AI. There is, I think, the almost all hardware companies, if not all the hardware companies, are just like clearly net negative. They're like rethinking into humanity's runway. So how do you kind of like turn that around is like a much tougher challenge than with AI companies. And so yeah, that was like what like kind of the one strategy. And then the other strategy that I've been doing is kind of like helping nonprofits and kind of co-founding two of them, the Cambridge Center and Future of Life Institute.
And so how do you go about making a decision on who to invest in? Is it just if they're receptive to you being a participant in the conversation around the strategy, or is it if you believe in the idea itself? How do you make that calculus?
I think it's just like case by case, because the group up until fairly recently who have been kind of working on potentially dangerous AIs like over a decade, it has been like fairly small group, and now it's of course exploding. So I just like got to know the people in it, and if they kind of started new companies. I mean, around the time that Anthropica started, there was like this like proliferation of these companies, like several kind of OpenAI, ex-OpenAI people started their own, and ex-Google people started their own, etc. So it's like kind of like tracking what's happening. So being with Anthropic concretely, it was just like I heard it pretty much from the news that like there's like this new company being formed, and it's just like called up Dario and asked like what's going on.
And what's the benefit, like Dario from Anthropic? You're a board observer at Anthropic, is that right?
Yeah.
And so what's the benefit to him and them of taking your money versus someone else that maybe isn't opinionated about the existential risks of what they're doing? How do you make that pitch? Hey, I'm going to be in your ear concerned about the safety of some of the things you're doing and that they willingly want that participation from you.
Yeah, the sort of game theoretic pitch I'm making to founders in general, founders who are basically developing deep technology and yeah, I'm most interested in investing in deep technology, including AI, is that, look, I don't have LPs, I don't have a boss when I invest, and I have like this sizable philanthropic operation where I want to make kind of things go well for humanity. So I have a credible ability to walk away from money in a way that VCs, I mean, legally they probably can, but like it's kind of like up to the particular person that you end up with on your board, etc. Because like they also heavily incentivized to make money for their LPs, lest they have trouble like next fundraising and whatnot. So yeah, my usual pitch is that like, yeah, if you take money from VCs, there will be pressure for you to show optimized profits, to take that kind of military contract and whatnot. Whereas like, if you like feel uneasy about what you might be doing, that could be kind of dangerous or negative, like, I'm totally fine leaving my money on the table, and we can even shut down the company if we feel that that's not ethically good thing to do.
Have you ever had an entrepreneur say no to you because of your interests, or at the point that they get far enough in the conversation with you, is it pretty clear where you're aligned, and so you don't actually get to that point?
Yeah, I never met like anyone who was kind of like, okay, this is like weird science fiction guy, and like I don't want to be associated with that guy. Nope, never. Not the main reason, like we are sometimes I kind of like don't get invested in other kind of like usual mundane things that they have like a lot of investor interest, and then they need to like juggle like multiple parties and their different kind of requirements and constraints and kind of like pressure to close soon and whatnot.
Have there been companies that you've walked away from because they didn't have the appreciation of the risks or the ethics around what they were doing, or do you view that as an opportunity to, hey, better me than the next person that would provide them money, and so I can work on convincing them over time?
Yeah, I think it's kind of hard to decouple it from generally kind of like think that these people aren't great in terms of their ability to see the dangers and like. From the assessment that these people aren't great, period. But sure, I think like that, especially with hardware companies, as I earlier mentioned, I do have this like dilemma. It's kind of, I mean, almost all hardware companies, of course, they think they're doing a great thing, and kind of providing a service to humanity. I'm like, no, you're not. And then almost all of them, not like literally all of them.
Can you explain that point for people that maybe aren't as familiar with the trade-offs or the capacity constraints between hardware and software today? What point you're making on that?
Current AI paradigm is basically, I call it summon and tame. Using a simple method that is very, very compute intensive, you summon a mind from mind space, and then you're going to like start investigating it. What does it look like? What can it do? What can you teach it? Can you teach it manners? Or like, will it like still pull a Bing on you? or like could it potentially even dangerous? Is it deceptive? Does it hallucinate, et cetera, et cetera? But these are things kind of like when you only you only discover in the later, like I call it taming phase, once you have summoned it. But the important bit is like for summoning, it's like summoning or like pre-training, as it's officially called. This is like very capital and compute and electricity intensive process. So any company who is like making that process easier is basically making the summoning easier. And making it like enabling more and more and or more powerful minds being summoned. So in that sense, sometimes I say that the remaining runway that humanity has is not measured in wall clock time, but in kind of CPU or GPU clock cycles. So like if you are a hardware company that provides more ability to compute, you're basically shortening the runway in real time because you're running through these cycles, remaining cycles for humanity quicker.
It sounds like Demis had read some of your writings or at least some of your talks or whatever it was when you went up and talked to him at the conference. Did it seem that he had an appreciation for the risks associated with AI in your mind at that point in time?
Yeah, I think so. Like I never got like pushback on sort of like fundamentals from him. Of course, like, I mean, in general, like kind of AI company leaders like him, they're quite constrained in what they kind of say, what they can do, because they have to think about like what signals they are sending to their employees, what signals they're sending to their business partners, or like in Demis's case, his kind of immediate superiors in Google, etc. So it's I can speak much more freely than he ever can,
but the point being he appreciates all this stuff, and I guess it went to the point of actually setting up an ethics board as a condition of this sale to Google, which I think you were involved in. Can you talk through like I guess the process of the sale and how you thought about that exit and then setting up the ethics board and what ultimately came of it?
So I wasn't like super involved in this ethics board thing, other than, yes, it was kind of like stipulated in the sale agreement. And like, yeah, that the kind of worry was that Google is, at that point at least, kind of completely unaware of AI dangers in a way that that DeepMind kind of increasingly was aware. And then my good friend and fellow board member at DeepMind representing Founders Fund, Luke Nosek, who was and still is very, very concerned about AI. Like he was like, I think one of the primary forces are kind of pushing for this, some kind of intervention to address the problem that like you have like this increasingly safety conscious group being sold to a group that doesn't really care about long-term safety issues. So yeah, that's how it got into the agreement. But of course, what happened afterwards, I don't actually have any visibility to, because once Google owned DeepMind, I could just only visit as a guest there.
Now I'm going to ask a seemingly random question that I think you'll appreciate, but you will kind of take us into the state of the industry today. So what do you think the biggest failing of the nuclear power industry was, and why it wasn't able to succeed, or why it's been so slow to adoption over the course of the last 40 years?
So, I mean, if I were to believe Stuart Russell, Stuart Russell makes this point that nuclear industry has been just like overconfident and being like too dismissive about the potential risks. And then like when the risks materialized, it was basically shut down. And Stuart Russell says that like, look, AI, fellow AI people, we shouldn't, if you want to kind of want the AI as a field to kind of persist, we shouldn't make the same mistake. I mean, that said, I don't actually know enough about the nuclear industry to be kind of like confident like how plausible this theory is.
But the point being, and I guess your perspective there is that
artificial intelligence industry should be upfront, communicative, and transparent, careful with the trade-offs and risks that are being taken at the expense potentially of inhibiting what the industry could be at some point in the future if controlled and regulated appropriately. Is that fair?
Yeah, there is this, I guess like Stuart's point is to kind of like relay this lesson from nuclear that like shouldn't kind of mislead the public about the risks that you're taking. So yeah, that's like one argument. I think like there's like stronger argument, like AI developers also want to live. That's like, I think like at least partially motivating these like the recent signatures on these open letters that look AI could be potentially dangerous because people closer to the risks, just like Manhattan Project scientists, they basically are more informed about what the ultimate risks are.
How would you characterize the risk of artificial intelligence today?
There's so many ways to characterize it, and the confusion it depends on like the audience. Sometimes you even ask them like people question like two questions, like A, can you program, and B, do you have children? And then you get like four different quadrants to kind of explain the problem. Also, it depends on like how is like somewhere. I'm not talking to some like leader in high up. Or like I'm talking to some engineer. So like, for example, for political leaders, one explanation I have is that, you can think of AI as an automated decision-making machine that is not human, it does not care about humans. We as a civilization are in the process of delegating more and more decisions to those non-human machines that do not care about humans. And like there is competitive pressure to delegate more and more because we will get faster and hopefully more competent decisions. But like as every leader knows, whenever you delegate something, you will get something else than you originally wanted. You have like this principal agent problem. So that's like one sort of very neutral way of framing it.
What about to the average listener that is curious about all of this stuff and has seen OpenAI in the news and all the advancements and played around with ChatGPT? How do you go about the framing of what's going on right now and why they should potentially be concerned or cautious about this?
Yeah, so several ways of putting it. Like one way is to kind of make this species argument that humanity has been like the top species. And like, let's not forget what the name of our species is. It's Homo sapiens. And sapiens means smart/wise. And even though we are smart and wise, the thing that we are engaged in, the AI labs are engaged in, and by extension, humanity is engaged in, is trying to make AI as smart as quickly as possible while using the fact that it is dumb to control it. So like this thing cannot go on forever. Like how long can it go on? We don't know. But at one point, it will be just too smart for us to be able to control it.
In the comparison that I guess like the last time intelligence at a comparable level was introduced in the world, it ultimately led to 85% of mammal extinction, right? Which is what humans have done to our world today, not necessarily because we were malicious towards those entities or that we wanted them to die, but that our goals were orthogonal to them living, right? And so can you talk through like that point and how it doesn't actually need to be good or bad? It can just be totally separate from the goal that something that's super intelligent is seeking?
One point that this example of us having wiped out so many other species is that it is really dangerous to share an environment with other, like a species that is more smarter, more expensive than you. And because we are biological, we are very sensitive to changes in the environment. I mean, the biggest kind of acknowledged global issue, global warming, talks about like the temperature and related changes that are like very, very minor on a scale of like astronomical scale, like 5 to 10 degrees or whatever the current thing is, like 6 degrees per century change in the temperature of the planet is nothing compared to what the actual temperature differences are when you can zoom out from the planet. And furthermore, it's very unlikely that this particular environment is like the best environment for non-human minds. So once they become sufficiently capable of actually starting to modify the environment in a way that like humans really, really have. This planet went from, in the last 5,000 years, this planet went from producing forests to producing cities. So once we have the equivalent in AI, like we will likely die as a result of environment just becoming completely uninhabitable for biologicals. And there's even more extreme scenarios when I think about, like, look, what the one thing that the AI is likely interested in is free energy. And almost all the free energy resides in the hydrogen of the sun. So that is like the main kind of like pot of gold that the AI will, once it becomes like at least as smart as I am, without any constraints. And the really important bit is that the current pre-training doesn't put any meaningful constraints on AI. We don't really know how to motivate. And more generally, we don't know how to motivate AIs. We know how to make them behave in a certain way in a certain situations, but we don't know how to motivate. So if we have like an AI that has orthogonal motivations, random motivations, just like humans have random motivations, when you kind of compare it to the motivations that evolution ideally should have installed in us from its perspective, then like we should worry about things like disruption to the sun.
I think that even the people that won't willingly sign a letter, like the furthest extreme of AI optimist, and maybe we'll put Jan LeCun from Facebook as an example of that, even they would acknowledge this resource trade-off orthogonal goal-seeking issues, I think. But I think their pushback or their distinction is that this alignment problem isn't as hard to solve as people like yourself and Eliezer and others make it out to be. And so actually getting the AI in alignment with humans' interests, if we made it, we control it, therefore we can ultimately direct it in a way that we see fit. Can you talk through how you think about that and why alignment is such a hard problem to solve?
So, I mean, first of all, I might be wrong. They might be right. So it's like...
I hope so. Like,
I also hope so. But like the problem is that...
You don't get to say, I told you so, by the way. I'm sure you've thought about that. You don't get to you celebrate at the end of you being right.
Exactly. Sometimes I think about like if you end up like surviving this decade, it's the future, like the 2030s, basically look like me being wrong about many, many things. So like there's like this unfortunate...
There's going to be a lot of people saying, I told you so, and calling you wacko, but at least you'll be alive to hear it.
That
so
is like I the logical conclusion. And like, that's why I'm also I don't want to kind of be like fanatical in my views. I always kind of leave some probability that I just might be wrong in general. Also that one lesson that I've learned from like years of investing and trading and whatnot. One reason why I'm not like really consoled by people like Jan LeCun is that their arguments are just really, really bad. When they say that this thing is easy, it would be really useful if they could actually kind of like give a recipe. Like the current situation is that we as kind of technology developers really don't know how to install motivations in AI. And this is like important kind of insight from some of the people in alignment community, like Ivan Hubinger. The way we are producing AIs we are using a loss function to create like this landscape like of this
virtual. Can you define loss function, by the way, just for people?
Yeah, this is going to go into the weeds.
Or can you frame it without loss function?
When we train AIs, train kind of machine learning systems, the training regime is set up in a way that kind of call always monitors what the AI does. If it does the correct thing based on some criteria, then it gets like rewarded. If it does the like incorrect thing, then it gets punished in some sense. That's like the essence of reinforcement learning, and like more generally, like its brain gets modified to be more likely to do the right thing in the similar situations in the future.
When I ask a question of ChatGPT, it responds, and then there's an option that says, "Was this helpful?" or whatever, exactly. And there's a thumbs up.
So that's
the reinforcement.
That's
word.
Like, I mean, it's more nuances than there. Probably like your thumbs up and will not like directly go to the system. There will be some kind of like filter and reviewing system, I suspect.
But it's providing feedback
exactly.
on the accuracy
exactly.
of what the question
now,
is.
Now, the interesting, like important bit is that when you are doing that, when we are doing that, when the AI communities is doing something like that, we are giving feedback on the behavior. We are not giving feedback on what this thing actually wants to do. So it's, and that important is that there are multiple, for every given behavior in a given context, there are multiple reasons, multiple motivations that give you like identical behavior. Like one simple toy example, I think Ivan Hubinger even uses it, is that imagine that you have a labyrinth and you're training an AI to exit the labyrinth as quickly as possible. So your loss function, the function that kind of like evaluates how the AI is doing, and giving like this like thumbs up, thumbs down feedback is how much time has passed and like how close you are to the exit of the labyrinth. Exits of the labyrinth, they have like green exit signs. When you're using the loss function that evaluates its ability to exit, evaluates the AI's ability to exit the labyrinth, you can swap that loss function for a loss function that evaluates AI's ability to see green as quickly as possible. And like you will get the same behavior. So like when you are using one of those loss functions, you don't actually know which kind of AI you will get. Either the AI that wants to get out really quickly or the AI that just like wants green as quickly as possible. So like that's the thing that happened to humans. Like evolution was selecting us for ability to self-reproduce. But like effectively, it ended up selecting a bunch of like heuristics that were kind of correlated with like simple, easy to access environmental features, such as like the presence of fatty food or sweet or ability, like availability of sex, etc. These motivations gave like identical or like very, very, very similar behavior, sufficiently similar behavior in ancestral environment compared to the having the correct motivation of like self-reproducing. Once we're out of the ancestral environment, the training environment, we suddenly invent condoms, we invent ice cream, we go to the moon and like stop reproducing to a large degree. The same worry is there, like that you will kind of, we are training AIs to exit labyrinths, and we think that like we are motivating AI to exit labyrinths, but no, we are creating something that has like very different motivations and just exiting labyrinth because of some other heuristic that it has just like randomly accumulated. And like once it's out, once we're going to release it, or very importantly, it could kind of self-release. Like I think there's like a false dichotomy between training and deployment. Like once you get AI smarter and smarter, the risk of them self-deploying becomes bigger and bigger. So like, I think we should not just be careful about what we deploy, we should also be careful about what we train, because we might be training things whose motivations we don't control and then they might self-release.
So I want to say that back to you and make sure I'm following. But essentially, if we draw the parallels, which I think are helpful to intelligence in humans, we were solving for like the actual genetic outcome that was being prioritized was reproduction. And that was like the goal ostensibly that we were pursuing. But along the way, and there were certain heuristics that that maximalized reproduction and continued sustenance in our environment. Along the way, our intelligence and goal seeking started to deviate from that pursuit, and condoms were introduced, or ice cream was introduced, or going to the moon was introduced. And so actually setting the course of what the goal is and the implications around that goal was very hard for even humans. And in that case, it led to 85% mammal extinction along the way, even though the only goal was reproduction. Is that a fair characterization?
I mean, almost. Like, I mean, of course, like if you were like, if evolution ended up installing in us like the correct motivation of self-reproduction, then we would like reproduce like hell. But that probably also means like killing off like other species. So it's the kind of the survival of other species is not that other species should not feel safe if we would have like this correct. I'm just like me, and like I think Eliezer also is using this like fact that humans are misaligned with evolution. And that misalignment comes from like very similar problem that AI research community currently has because like evolution didn't know how to motivate us, and AI community doesn't know how to motivate AIs.
So what do you think of people that aren't concerned with this and they just say, hey, it's not that hard of a problem? Do you think they're being disingenuous? Do you think that they haven't given it that much thought? Like the people that the people that argue against you, if you were to frame them in the most optimistic presentation that you possibly can, what's your view on what their motivations are or what they don't agree with in that you're saying?
I mean, the most optimistic view, of course, is that they know nothing, something that we, like myself and people who are concerned about it, and including many people who are kind of like down in the weeds of training AIs, they know something that that we don't know.
Yeah. I think it would be great if they articulated that as well.
Exactly. It would be like very useful. It's like, let's just like, don't be shy, as Eliezer says. Don't be shy. Just tell us, like, how do you intend to motivate AIs once it's potentially smarter than you?
And so do you think that they are just motivated by other... I mean, presumably they don't want to die either, or they don't want to wipe out humanity, I think. And so do you think it's a naivety that if they don't have some secret that they're not sharing with us, do you think there's something malicious, or do you think it's just they haven't thought that critically about it?
I mean, it depends on person, obviously. Like different people have different... I think like one of my worthiest opponents who I had a great debate with is Robin Hanson, who both like is kind of skeptical of AI risk and not like dismissive of it, but skeptical, and has thought about it. So it's kind of like interesting exception to the rule. But the rule, yes, is that people who are dismissive of AI risk, unsurprisingly, they don't think about it. So like when they are basically asked to produce arguments, the arguments are crap because they haven't thought about it.
For folks that want to hear Robin Hanson, he was on episode 59 with me as well. And so people can go listen to some of his takes on that. So you've been a part of this industry now, I guess, for 13 years, which I think makes you one of the older people with a more longitudinal perspective of what's happened. ChatGPT, I think, was a big breakthrough for a lot of people's understanding and at least the mainstream adoption of that. So what was your perspective when you saw that launched?
I mean, I saw like some early transcripts of GPT-4 before it was released, and Yeah, it was very unnerving.
What was unnerving about GPT-4 versus GPT-3?
It just was much more consistent. Like the main, I think like many people have this like misguided assumption that like there is this kind of magic dust called intentionality, volition, that is just like missing in like non-human minds, and like we don't even know how to install it, so like we shouldn't be like afraid at all of something that that is like machine mind, because it doesn't have its own volition, its own intention. I think it's just completely misguided. It's like heat-seeking missile has like a lot of intention that it's kind of makes it very uncomfortable being on the other end of. Intention is cheap. What is expensive at least in the current AI paradigm is long-term consistency. So like, I mean, the big thing that currently is, the big technical term that is currently correlated with it, at least, is the size of the context window. Like how much context can the system have before it makes a new decision. So like that was like very impressive jump up from GPT-3 to GPT-4 about like the AI being consistent, remembering things that it said earlier, and like not kind of just talking at cross purposes to each other. But still, like GPT-4, like the context window is much smaller than humans have. We can like still recall like facts from like when we were kids and kind of base our decisions on those things. So like the heartbeat is basically to make AIs having long-term, consistent and coherent plans. And like seeing this like massive jump up from GPT-3 to GPT-4, like makes me think like, oh, how many such jumps in planning ability, smart, consistent planning ability we can still afford before we find ourselves at the receiving end of the plan that we don't like.
So after you saw GPT-4 launch, you initiated the call for a 6-month pause. Is that right? And how did that actually come to be? How did you go about pursuing it?
Yeah, so in early March, I wrote like a small memo that I kind of like shared with like AI safety community and some AI developers, where I just like pointed out that like there's like increased uneasiness post ChatGPT launch among like wider and wider circle of people, like Ezra Klein's New York Times piece, as well as Yuval Harari's New York Times pieces had come out, and there were like increasing calls for some kind of action intervention from like different people. So I, in that memo, I proposed kind of like two potential interventions. One was doing some kind of survey, like in kind of AI development, AI labs, about like what is the internal view about how much risk the labs are currently taking when they develop frontier models. Because like the Manhattan Project scientists, they did just that before the first detonation of a nuclear device. They did a calculation about what is the probability of actually destroying the planet using this their creation. So I think like this is like a homework that I think technology developers in general should be doing. And like now that there is kind of increased uneasiness in the labs, I think this is like a valuable homework to be doing and kind of creating common knowledge about. And the other thing, if I remember correctly, I proposed is like what about like creating some kind of moratorium before we have this like numbers, or like before we have sufficient certainty about the risks being sufficiently small, shouldn't we like start advocating for like slowdown? And there were like some Katja Grace, for example, published an article on Less Wrong about isn't it the time to slow down? And like just like kind of arguing against the usual counter arguments about slowing down being unrealistic. So like yeah, after that memo, like kind of waited for a couple of weeks, got like a bunch of great comments. And then I think around March 20, we had like Future Flight Institute's call. I had, of course, shared the memo with these people as well, my co-founders there. And I think somebody there just proposed, okay, we have like ability to do open letters. Why don't we just like actually put this in practice and do another one and see like how many signatures we're going to get.
So you published it. You got signatories on it with you, including Elon Musk came in and signed it as well. Was your intention just to raise heightened awareness? Did you actually think we were going to be able to get a 6-month pause out of it? Why 6 months versus anything else?
Yeah, I mean, so many things to say about that. The intention with the letter was to kind of create what's known common knowledge. That like we kind of are seeing these like signs of more and more people inside the labs and outside the labs, kind of being worried about, wait a minute, what is this thing? Like, what is this ChatGPT thing? Like, where is this going? Like, is this something that we signed up for? But there wasn't like common knowledge in the sense that like people know that other people also know. So like, it's kind of like one thing that when you like say that I'm uneasy about this, you don't know like how many people think like you. The main argument for putting in 6 months was to kind of have something that is more realistic and more concrete and also like more informative when it fails. So like if you call for indefinite pause, then like we expected the reaction to be like, oh yeah, like this is completely unrealistic. Like what do you mean indefinite, etc. So that's why we wanted create a situation where it's kind of clear people can't even pause for 6 months. The other thing was like this, the China argument that like it's easier to advocate for like a small pause and see like if this is possible in a situation where like the most common counter argument is that, well, if we pause, then like China kind of just rushes ahead and gets an advantage and whatnot. Not that I believe in that particular argument, but like it was like a pragmatic thing to put in.
How would you deem the success? If those were the intentions, obviously it didn't happen, but we have had a statement of AI risk, which you signed along with Sam Altman and Jeffrey Hinton, actually resigned from Google and is now speaking more publicly about it. Demis from DeepMind and Dario from Anthropic signed the statement of AI risk as well. So if you were rating yourself on the original intentions of the 6-month pause, knowing ultimately you failed, did it actually succeed in the mission, or what grade would you give the call for a pause?
I mean, counterfactuals are very hard. It's kind of very hard for me to imagine what the world looks like if it didn't put out this letter. I'm very confident that the main kind of causal factor is kind of ChatGPT here. Like the reason why it was easy to get this, to make this letter and get a lot of signatures was because of ChatGPT. If it had done it like before ChatGPT, I'm pretty sure we could have like definitely get like less than 1,000 signatures. And the second AI extinction statement would not have happened. So yeah, I think OpenAI sort of like gets most of the credit for alerting society. But yeah, like it's actually very hard for me to know. I should probably just ask Dan Hendricks about like would they have put out this extinction statement, which I think is like super, super useful. Had FLI not created the open letter.
How has your reaction been to the response and the progress and the changes that have happened since you put out the letter?
I mean, I sort of like was hoping to getting like a lot of resonance from the larger society. And again, like the early signs were there that like more and more people not directly involved in AI are thinking about like what this situation now is. Like 2023 feels significantly different from earlier years.
There's effectively a big three in my mind right now in artificial intelligence with regard to large language models. There's Microsoft / OpenAI, Google / DeepMind, and then also the far smallest, but also a very prominent one right now is Anthropic. as well. You've obviously invested in two of the three underpinning technologies, I guess. To ask you about the first and perhaps the most prominent of it, OpenAI, what's your perspective on their attitude towards the risks associated with this? Sam obviously signed that statement of AI risk. He talks about this quite a bit. What's your perspective on how they're acting versus what they're saying? And are they just accelerating the inevitability in your mind? Or do you think they're being pragmatically cautious?
I mean, I'm thankful to be able to live in a world where like the top labs, the heads of like the leaders of the top labs, they are conscious of the problem and being kind of like saying so. Especially Sam, I think Sam has been like the most kind of public about the extreme risk concerns. But like that doesn't change the fact that I think it's just like very reckless for any lab at the moment using the current paradigm to push the frontier because these are like uncontrollable minds that are being summoned in the hopes that they're not very competent and can't make these like long-term plans. And like these hopes just come with a certain risk that they might be wrong.
I'm going to ask you the hard questions that Eliezer at least refuses to be pinned down on, but what percentage likelihood do you think we're on a path to extinction?
It depends on timelines. Like a billion years?
That
sure.
was the second question. So I'll let you weigh in on timelines as well.
I mean, if it's like GPT-5 that kills us, then it's like 95% or something like that. So something which comes very soon using the current paradigm, because really, really, we don't know how to motivate AI. If it turns out that like this entire LLM paradigm, like my good friend Kerry Marcus argues, is just misguided, it's not going to get us the very competent AIs, then we will have more breathing room. We might even have like a couple of decades left still, and we need to like invent some more things. And now that there is like more realization that AI safety is a big problem, we might actually accomplish things that make us substantially safer in the next 20 years, because the entire field of AI safety, I mean, people, including myself, have gone back to like people like Alan Turing and Norbert Wiener, IJ Good, who basically 60 years ago or so already kind of mentioned that like AI safety is going to be a big problem. But the field really started something like 10, 15 years ago. So like if you would have like another 20 years or so, then I would be starting already kind of leaning optimistic that like the probability of us actually surviving is more likely than not. But like currently it looks like we're not going to have 20 years.
You think it's sub 20 years, and what probability would you put on ChatGPT or GPT-5 being the cause, if you were to just extrapolate the gains from 3 to 4 to 4 to 5 in some way, what probability would you put that risk at?
Yeah, so the probability that I used in my memo in early March, and I still kind of stand by it, I haven't like heard strong counter arguments to that, is 1 to 50%, so like super wide confidence range, because I'm just like very, very uncertain of complete wipeout of humanity per 10xing of compute that is being thrown at these experiments. So I think my current understanding, and I'm not an OpenAI insider, so I might be wrong about this, is that like the difference between GPT-4 and GPT-5 is going to be more than 10x. So we're probably talking about a couple of percent chance of OpenAI wiping out everyone later this year, possibly.
That's quite ominous. What would you recommend if people hear this and it's the average person, what would you recommend that they actually do about, let's say maybe they think you could be right. How would you propose that they respond to that?
It's kind of hard for me to give like recipes for sort of common people. I think like the general thing that we would want, and there's like increasingly big consensus, is some kind of compute governance that like there wouldn't be like complete like free for all throwing of compute at these uncontrollable AI experiments. Like ideally, we should have like a cap on how much compute you can spend on these experiments, or like growing those AIs that you actually don't control. So like any kind of advocacy towards that, I think currently is positive. There always could be like kind of like negative side effects, etc. Like nobody's safe from that. Sort of putting more pressure on the leading frontier model developers. I mean, currently there are three of them, but like there probably would be more as like this technology becomes more widely available, the training technology, for them to kind of make an affirmative case, because like at least 1 to 50% is like my subjective estimate. And like I'm happy to revise it down if there was like some like strong arguments why it's like, for example, not possible for a large language model to self-deploy. What are the actual constraints and limits on this like training regime? Why are we confident that it can't kind of just spin out of control during the months as it's left unattended?
I realize it's hard to do the counterfactual, but I want to shift gears a little bit here. If not for AI and existential risk, which I think you've dedicated a large portion of the last 15-ish years to thinking about and investing behind and all of that, what do you think you would be doing if that concern didn't exist?
I mean, I definitely would be investing, which I am. Although, like, I have delegated away most of the kind of day-to-day legwork there, I would be building things, which I still am. In fact, I was coding earlier today, and I would be dancing. That's my main hobby: freestyle street dancing.
So it sounds like you'd be doing more of the same, but you would just have time that you don't currently have.
Yeah, yeah. And I think like one way how this is healthy to have like these side things is that there's like this automatic concern, especially with like Elon, that like when he says something that I think is like reasonable, people always have suspicion, like why is he saying that? What are his actual kind of interests? And in my case, it's like, yeah, well, I have these other things. Like I really love dancing. I would like to just go and dance instead of like, I'm not going to get my like positive hedons from just talking about AI risk. I actually much rather be dancing.
Well, last one, then I'll let you hop. What's a piece of conventional wisdom around startups or investing or anything that you disagree with today?
I mean, I guess like the sort of like the obvious one actually is that, yeah, this kind of steamroller thing in general, people, including people in technology, seem to have this assumption that like technology is now ready. And like in the future, we will have a little bit thinner iPhones, and that's about it. Whereas, like basically the changes that might be coming, people are just like completely underestimating it. Of course, the question is that because the changes are hard to predict, even though like you might kind of like have like some idea about what will happen in the limit, but like how we get to the limit, and like what the actual kind of chaos that might happen once we have like billions of non-human minds that are roughly at the level of college students, like in kind of interacting with us and are kind of in space all the time, how big chaos that will create, like, I don't know, but it's like very plausible that just like super big change compared to like default expectations of slightly thinner phones.
Well, Jan, thank you for doing this and making the time and sharing all your lessons that you learned and your perspective. It's a super interesting conversation.
Thank you very much.